The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your fullest and healthiest life. In its 70 years, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has evolved from a malaria control program to an institution dedicated to improving health for all people across the world. Today, I have the incredible honor of being joined by its former director and public health luminary, Dr. William Fagy. In his career, Dr. Fagy has been a part of pivotal movements in public health, including eradication of smallpox in the late 1970s, and the discovery of Legionnaire's disease, Reye syndrome, toxic shock syndrome, and HIV/AIDS. From threats of terrorist attacks to congressional hearings to tensions in the field, Dr. Fagy has behind-the-scenes insight into the biggest successes in public health and lessons learned for overcoming crises and improving the health of our nation. Dr. Fagy was the director of the Centers for Disease Control between 1977 to 1983. He was the president and co-founder of the Task Force for Global Health from 1984 to 1999, senior fellow of the Global Health Program for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, executive director of the Carter Center from 1986 to 1992, and continues to serve as health policy fellow for the Carter Center. He's emeritus presidential distinguished professor of international health at Emory University. Dr. Fagy is also the author of House on Fire, The Fight to Eradicate Smallpox, published in 2011, and The Fears of the Rich, The Needs of the Poor, My Years at the CDC, published in 2018. In 2012, he was awarded Presidential Medal of Freedom. Dr. Fagy, I'm so honored to have you here today. What I want to do is begin by getting your perspective and philosophy about public health.
Okay, the first question on a test in medical school turned out to be so interesting that I keep remembering it. It was in submicroscopic histology, and we studied so hard. I still remember the periodicity of collagen fibrils and things like that. But we had one question: what is life? And I thought, now, isn't that, at first it got me angry, because I had no idea that I was studying for that question. But then I get thinking about it over the years, how we have to step back and look at big pictures all the time. And I was talking to the state health officers years ago when, during the question period, someone asked me, what is the philosophy behind public health? And I said, the philosophy behind science is trying to find truth, breaking down the walls of ignorance. The philosophy behind medicine is to use that truth for every patient. The philosophy behind public health is to use that truth for everyone. Therefore, the base philosophy is social justice. And a man by the name of Dr. Cannon, health officer for Rhode Island, jumped up and he said, I've been health officer for 50 years and I've never heard that. And I intuitively know it's true. Don't ever give a talk again without saying that. So that's the philosophy behind public health. How do you apply things to everyone? In medical school, we heard repeatedly, do no harm. First, do no harm. And it attracts your attention. But it really got my attention in 1965 when we were on our way to Africa. And my supervisor's parting words to me, by the way, he said, it was almost a throwaway line, by the way, you'll never forget the people you kill. And that just bothered me and bothered me. And then I realized that's not true. I will forget the people I kill because we kill far more people through errors of omission and never know that. And every time I heard that in medical school, it had to do with an error of commission. Well, that makes a certain amount of sense because we were seeing the numerator. And so you make errors when you see the numerator. With public health, you're seeing the denominator And we kill far more people by not sharing our science, by not using our vaccines, by not distributing the tools that we have. And then I came to realize recently that the phrase "do no harm" actually applies to the numerator in a very sad way. We hear that, people go into practice, they don't get reimbursed for prevention advice. They don't have time for it. They have only so many minutes per patient. They can't get into smoking and exercise and diet and all of these things. And so they don't talk about it. And so now I see that phrase as being a pious phrase that people don't really care about. It is sort of like "do no harm" unless there's money involved. And you know, that just hurts to think of it that way, but that's what has happened. Well, in public health, the basis of it is to see what you can do for the denominator. And so we get into things like disease eradication. We get into all of the things we take for granted, that our water is safe, that our food is safe, that our air is safe. And you don't actually see people. And it's one of the things people miss when they go into public health, that they are so used to getting a certain gratification from patients who are happy with what they've done. And that doesn't happen in public health. I tell students going into public health, I can almost guarantee you two things. You won't get rich, and you'll never be thanked. But then I quote the woman who produced pertussis vaccine in Michigan in the 1930s. When she died in 1969, the dean of the School of Public Health at Michigan, Bill Remington, said that no one ever thanked her because no one ever knew. He said there are hundreds of thousands of people alive because she developed pertussis vaccine. He said, can you name even one? He said, I can't either. So he said she never got thanked, but she was secure in the knowledge of what she had done. Mm-hmm. And so that's what you have to tell public health people. Get some joy out of seeing faces behind graphs, but you're not going to be thanked.
Well, you know, it's fascinating all the different things you touched on about this phrase "do no harm," which, you know, ever since you're in medical school, we all hear. And you're absolutely right. We always apply it to really errors by treatment, mm-hmm. as opposed to errors of omission, or not necessarily even errors, but just lack of time or access or availability to reach people. Mm-hmm. So just the omission of the health inequity and the omission of how our health system is structured to deliver the type of care that would really prevent illness for all people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, you know, comes down to what are the causes behind the causes and the causes behind that, right? There's so many layers. We think of the causes of death as chronic disease now as the leading causes, right? Heart disease, diabetes, cancer. You know, you wrote a seminal paper in 1993 in the Journal of American Medical Association looking at the actual causes of death, you know, narrowing it down to three representing 40%, that being tobacco, physical inactivity, and diet. Back then, to have made that type of conclusion in a paper, what was the environment? How was that received?
Well, it's interesting, and I don't take credit for thinking of it. It was Mike McGinnis who came to me and said, you know, we really should write about this. And so Mike McGinnis, who's still involved in medicine in Washington, D.C., we sat down and tried to figure this out. It came a little bit as a surprise that 40% of all deaths were due to three things, all three of them preventable, all three of them preventable by our individual actions. And sometimes I'm asked, what's the greatest development in medicine in the 20th century? It's not a vaccine. It's not a drug. It's the fact that we have given power to individuals to be able to change their life in ways far beyond what medicine and vaccines and drugs can do. We don't often always use that information, but nonetheless, it's there. And so people make millions and millions of decisions every day about what they eat and exercise, sunscreen, putting on seat belts, and so forth. And it has changed what has happened. This is true globally also. I often hear people say that money put into global health is money down the drain. You can't show any improvement. You can show massive improvement. Smallpox, you mentioned. Last century, 300 million people died of smallpox. This century, not a single one. And measles, when I started out, it was the single most lethal agent in the world. There were categories like diarrheal disease and respiratory disease that may have killed more children, but they were various viruses and bacteria and so forth. But measles virus alone was killing over 3 million children a year. And I used to think about that. 3 million places at dinner that were now empty. And think what that means for 3 million families. And then each year adding 3 million more on. That figure has gone from 3 million to 2 million to 1 million, and it's down to about 100, 150,000 at the present time. Over and over, you can see the great changes that have taken place, and still people say that is money lost. It's not something that we should be doing.
You know, and as these threats from infectious disease, we've done a tremendous job through public health addressing. You know, we've now seen chronic disease become the leading cause of death. And now, as you know from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation supporting the Global Burden of Disease study, one in five deaths in 2017 was linked to poor diet. That's worldwide in 195 countries. I mean, that's so profound that, as you're saying, we have this knowledge, and the biggest gift that people have this century is the ability, the empowerment to make a difference in their own health outcome. Yet we still have 255 million healthy years of life lost in 2017, and one in five deaths globally just from poor dietary intake. What do we need to do to get public health in this century to address this global risk?
First of all, I think we need to look at how we organize globally. And I've been saying this for some years, that we do not have a very efficient system globally. We criticized WHO during the Ebola outbreak of 2014-15 because they didn't respond very well. And they didn't respond very well. But we couldn't blame them. The problem with WHO was when they were formed, the United States insisted on strong regional offices, because we had PAHO already in this region, and they wanted to strengthen PAHO. So they insisted on strong regional offices, and that's what they got. So regional offices can undermine Geneva anytime they want to, and they often want to. When the Ebola outbreak developed, the first battle was between the African Regional Office and Geneva on who would be in charge. The one thing they could agree on was they would not ask CDC in, because they had so much experience with Ebola, they know that they knew they could finish this and get the credit. What they didn't know is what happened to Ebola when it got into an urban setting, and then it was almost uncontrollable. One exception, Nigeria got Ebola in Lagos, and Lagos is 20 million people. I mean, it's really a massive urban area. And when Ebola went to Nigeria, immediately epidemiologists followed up with every contact, hundreds of contacts every day, following people for temperature. And you know why? Because they'd been trained at CDC in epidemiology. And so we knew that there were ways to prevent this. But that was number one. The regional offices were so strong. Then number two, 195 ministers of health constitute their board. And no one would run a company, they wouldn't agree to be a CEO of a company in this country if they had a board of 195 people. And it's not just 195 people. These people turn over so fast. They spend 2 or 3 years as Minister of Health, and then someone else comes in. So they don't have the allegiance to WHO. And number three, the United States also, with other countries, every year told WHO to reduce its budget. So is it any wonder that 2014 comes along and they don't have the manpower, women power, the money to actually respond to this? I often tell the story that I became so frustrated once years ago when the U.S. was not paying its dues to WHO. And I wrote an editorial and I quoted Dolly Parton, because Dolly Parton said, "You'd be surprised how much it costs to look this cheap." And in 2014, we found how much it cost to be that cheap with WHO. Now, I lost my way here. You asked me a question and I got going on WHO. But that's the first thing. We have to figure out how to reorganize the way we do this in the world. And I think the simplest thing would be is if the head of the UN put the head of WHO, the head of UNICEF, the head of the World Bank, the head of the UNDP, and said, come up with a plan that you can provide a group on health that will advise me. Not a new structure, not a new office, but if I ask you, how should we be handling the problem of Zika, that you will actually give me a plan that I can implement across the UN. And then make the head of WHO the chair of that group. That person would only get one vote, but there's something symbolic about now you know who's in charge. Now you don't know who's in charge. If we have an international health problem in this country, we never know who in the world is going to be taking responsibility, but we don't know who in this country will take responsibility. Will it be USAID? Will it be HHS? Will it be the Red Cross and so forth? And so we have to get ourselves organized. And I believe that medical work under USAID should not be in the State Department, because every decision gets tinged by politics. There should be one person in charge of health, and that's the Secretary of Health and Human Services, domestic and global. Therefore, when a decision is made domestically, the experience globally comes into that. When a decision is made globally, the experience domestically goes into that. So I believe that it should be the Secretary of HHS. But every time I've suggested that, the turf fighting, State Department doesn't want to give this up because to them it's very valuable. They can use this to mold opinion. And President Carter once told me if he had understood this when he was president, he could have changed it with an executive order, but he didn't understand it then.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, hearing your experience and watching the various outbreaks and the responses, and over the years, you know, being there in the, you know, process of the eradication of smallpox and being there for different outbreaks. Some of the responses have been tremendously effective, while the ones you mentioned, because of the lack of power of the World Health Organization, being maybe not as effective a response. When you look back on successes in public health and in global health, what do you think differentiated, like what are the main lessons of what led to a very successful response versus the ones that, you know, potentially were criticized and weren't as successful?
That's such a good question, because we see ourselves in this country as management gurus, that we should know how to do these things. With WHO, when I was working at CDC, but Dave Sensor was the director of CDC, he asked me to form a committee to figure out how could CDC improve global health. And our conclusion was, we're never going to have enough money at CDC to make a big difference, but we sure have a lot of experience. And why don't we choose the six most important places in the world where decisions are made on global health and offer them free our best decision makers. And Dave Sensor did that. So WHO for a period of time really had a great advantage. D.A. Henderson worked on smallpox eradication out of WHO. For 11 years, he was on CDC's payroll. Then Rafe Henderson headed up the EPI, the Expanded Program Immunization. He was on CDC's payroll. Mike Merson, who's now a dean at Duke, was on CDC's payroll as head of diarrheal diseases. Jonathan Mann, paid for by CDC, was head of HIV/AIDS. And the advantage of this was, for many people at WHO, it's the best job they've ever had, and they don't want to lose it. And therefore, they can't make bold decisions because they can't afford to get fired. If you are loaning someone, they have a place to go back to if they're asked to leave. At the same time, we get immediate access to what's happening at WHO, so it was to our benefit to do that. And that was a period of time that was just, I think it was the best in global health. The head of WHO at that time was a Danish physician, and he told me, "We will never thank you publicly because this works so well that we don't want to cause problems." But I have come to the conclusion every country could do that. They could offer people to WHO free of charge. WHO has to make the decision on who they actually take and when they want to get rid of them. But Hoffmann-Mahler, who was director at that time, he said, "This is the way we can balance the regions. Now we have to make sure that if this region has someone, that region has someone. If it's a free gift, it doesn't count in the mix." So I think we could really improve WHO by doing things like that. How did it help in smallpox? Well, CDC was pretty new, 20 years, 30 years old at that time. Same with WHO. Hoffmann-Mahler did not want to jeopardize his position with CDC. So he allowed D.A. Henderson to have a movement that he could not have had if he was an actual employee of WHO. He was able to get people from the outside to get money in and so forth. It worked so well. So we do have a model that we know has worked in the past. There's another model that I'm very pleased with, and that is when Merck decided to give Mectazan free for the prevention of onchocerciasis, river blindness. They had developed this for heartworm in dogs. And then a man from the subcontinent, Mohammed Aziz, went to Africa to test this in humans with onchocerciasis and found it was even better in humans than it was for heartworm in dogs. Heartworm in dogs, you give it once a month. With humans, you gave it once a year. And so Merck now had a drug that was cheap, would go to the poorest people in the world, but they couldn't make any money on it. They decided to give it away free. They went to WHO and offered it free if WHO would come up with a plan. And they finally walked away. WHO bureaucracy was such that they couldn't work with them. They then went to USAID and made the same offer, and USAID said, "We're not interested." They then came to the task force here in Atlanta, and now they're getting desperate. They can't even give this drug away. But they made the same offer. If we gave it free, would you figure out how to distribute it? And we had some concerns. What happens when you give a drug to a million people? What are the things you were not counting on? And if you get a death even in 100,000, by the time you get to a million, you have 10 deaths, you have a real problem. And so we were cautious at the beginning. But I also wondered, how can you get people to take this if the results aren't seen for 20 years? That is, they don't go blind. Well, within a week, we knew we had the answer to this, because this drug turned out to be not only good for onchocerciasis, 100% effective for roundworms. and people know when they've been treated for roundworms, 100% effective for whipworms. And many of these people had spent their life scratching. And we lived in a village in Nigeria, and I thought, I was so dumb because I would see that, but I never put it together. And so some of these people, the day after getting Mectazan, had their first scratch-free day in their lifetime that they could remember. I mean, so you didn't even have to do marketing after that. They sold it for you. This program isn't run by WHO or UNICEF or any UN organization. It's run by a committee that does not include anyone from Merck who makes the decision on who gets the drug. And it works so well, we thought we would reach 6 million people in 6 years. We did it in 4 years, and then it kept increasing. I went back to Africa for the 250 millionth treatment, all free from Merck. And now they have given something like 1.5 billion free treatments. So another model that works. It's not as if we don't have things that we can point to and say, this works.
And applying social justice to the most pressing public health issues domestically, I mean, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. What do you think are our national priorities right now in public health?
I think one of the real priorities is, if public health, in fact, is looking for equity, social justice, our healthcare system does not provide that. I think there are two ways that it could. One is a single-payer system, and even as recently as 2 years ago, you couldn't suggest that because people were so allergic to that idea. And they would always bring up, we do not want socialized medicine. And when they say that, you know they don't understand what socialized medicine is. Socialized medicine is when the government owns the hospitals and clinics and everything. That's not what people are talking about. So we get confused on just the nomenclature here. So that's one way, a single-payer system. The other way would be, and I think this is within our reach scientifically, is to come up with a way of actually measuring health outcomes. Because if you can do that, and you can't do it for an individual, but you can do it for an aggregate, 100,000 person days of experience and so forth, if you can measure health outcome and reimburse for that, suddenly it changes everything. So if you reimbursed current healthcare insurance companies, not only for how well they treat myocardial infarctions, but how they reduce the new ones, suddenly, smoke enders and diet programs and exercise programs would become part of curative medicine. And you would now have public health and medicine coming together. And if you can figure out how to do that, then the marketplace will allow you to do the same thing as a single-payer system. Both of these are going to be very difficult, but that's what we need is some sort of equity that you don't have millions of people who, we say they don't have coverage. Well, they go to emergency room, but that's not coverage.
No, and to your point earlier, it's the errors of omission that occurs by the time someone seeks care in an emergency room. For every one that gets to that end stage, of course, there are probably hundreds that are progressing towards disease.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.